is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Welcome, everybody. It's Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. This hour of Wyman and Bob is brought to you by Muckleshoot Casino. Coming up today, we'll spend the 3 o'clock hour with our buddy Michael Bumpus talking Seahawks. At 4 o'clock, the Professor John Clayton will be with us to talk everything NFL. El Hombre today at 4:30 because I believe we've got Ray Roberts at 5. So Ray Roberts will spend the 5 o'clock segment with us, and then El Hombre for 1 week will be with us at 4:30, so a little bit shorter segment for El Hombre. Hopefully, I'm guessing he'll come in yelling, kicking, screaming about the injustice of it all. That's what he's want to do.
Injustice of what?
Of him having a shorter segment today.
Oh, okay, gotcha. I thought there was a particular topic, which I'm sure there will be.
Oh, yeah, he'll be fired up about something. That's the beauty of El Hombre. So that's coming up at 4:30. Ray Roberts will talk O-line issues with him at 5 o'clock today, but want to get to a few different things centered around the Seahawks and opinions from the outside. It's always interesting because we get so caught up. We're so dialed into every moment, every aspect of this team. It's interesting to hear perspective from the outside, from somebody who's watching it from the outside and often much more objective at times. It's easier for them. Brandon Marshall weighed in on this, was talking about he thinks Pete is putting Russ in a box after a few bad games.
This is all bad in Seattle. This is a bigger story than we think. I just go back to Pete Carroll's exit interview. He said, we need to run the ball more. Let's go back to when Russell Wilson had that, 2-3 game skid. What did Pete Carroll do? He said, no, we're going to go back to running the ball. We're going to go back to playing Seattle football. Well, did Steve Kerr ever ask Steph Curry, you know, look, stop shooting the ball when he missed the shot or if he had a bad game or two or three? No, you don't do that. You can't put shooters in a box.
Can't put shooters in a box. Shooters got to keep shooting.
Well, that makes some sense, right?
It does in the NBA. You hear that all the time. you know, you got a shooter that goes 0-for-10. You keep firing the ball.
Right.
But are you going to lose because you miss a three? You missed 2 threes. Is that going to cost you the game? Maybe it could. It's not as dire, though. You're putting up many, many more shots than you are pass attempts and drives in a game. So if you kill a drive with a turnover, it's much more punitive than Steph Curry dribbling up the court, firing a three, clangs off the rim. Unless that's the last shot of the game, chances of that being the difference in the game, not often, right?
Yeah.
It's not the same value, I guess, is my point.
Well, and just the more, and we'll get into this later, but the more you dive into giveaways and takeaways in the NFL, they're huge, absolutely huge. So the thing is, though, yeah, if he's right there, that did he indeed handcuff Russell Wilson?
He kind of said as much. Pete said, I handcuffed him, but said he jumped in when the turnover started happening, that he basically got in the middle of it.
Right. And by the way, that's
those
started,
are his words, not our assumptions.
Right. And yeah, because I remember him saying that too. He wanted to, I don't know, did he use the phrase dial it back, something like that? The handcuffing part we got from Brock and Jake too, that, mm-hmm. you know, all of a sudden it's like, hey, I can't, you know, express myself. I can't go out and play the way I want to play, and compared him to being an artist. But that streak started at Arizona and then ended with the at LA Ram game. Mm-hmm. And in that period of time, they went 1-3. They only beat San Francisco. There was no giveaways in that game. I think it was zero. Cause I'm not sure if they, or we might've taken one away, but anyway, they went -5 in that 4-game streak, 1-3, 10 total giveaways in 4 games. Moore and I were looking at it. What about some of the end zone or red zone interceptions that he threw?
Right.
It seemed to us like a lot of them happened. I thought there was 4. There was actually 3. One was the Buda Baker. One was Xavier Howard. And then the other one was at LA Rams, or Howard was with Miami. At LA Rams, maybe the worst one he threw. And that's maybe the point where Pete probably was like, okay, I've got to do something here. And I think kind of pushed the panic button.
Mm-hmm.
Because what ends up happening, and let me describe the play first. It's second and five at the Ram 22-yard line, and Russell is scrambling. And I don't want to say it's guaranteed, but it's a really good chance that he picks up the first down scrambling. Mm-hmm. And then he just throws the ball off to his left. I think he was trying to hit either Hollister or Disley, and it gets picked off. You know, like, why on second and five would you take that chance? So as Mara and I were talking about, you know, it was like, well, why don't you just dial him back maybe in the red zone? Because that's where, like I said, the Buda Baker one. And then there was another one in Arizona where actually it was from the 35-yard line, but it was picked off in the end zone. It was Patrick Peterson.
Right.
It's the one where he thought DK was going to keep going.
Yeah.
And he didn't keep going, and Patrick Peterson did and ended up throwing it right to him. So maybe it should have, you know, dialed it back. But I was looking at the giveaways this year and thinking, okay, yeah, let's look at this versus, you know, years past. They had 18 giveaways this year. Now, maybe this is because Pete stepped in. But last year, they had 20. The year before that, 11. Okay, but the year before that and the year before that, so we're talking about now 16 and 15 or 16 and 17, which is a bad year. They gave it away 18 times those years as well.
Mm-hmm.
And really, if you average out the whole time that Pete's been here, it's about 18, 19 giveaways right. per game. And
so they ended up on their average.
Yeah, they ended up on their average. So, you know, was that because Pete stepped in, or was it just a natural process that was going to happen? And that Russ, you know, he threw 13 interceptions. He's only, I mean, that's his worst.
Yeah,
you know,
it was his best
11.
Year for touchdowns, worst year for interceptions.
Right. So, I mean, I guess you could make the case if you're looking at the numbers that maybe Pete overreacted. But you could also say, well, once Pete stepped in, then they stopped, you know, with the giveaways. The bigger problem was takeaways. I mean, they only had 22. I mean, they've had this is like their third worst year or second worst year as far as takeaways. You know, 19 in 2015, or 16, actually. And then, you know, 22nd, or they have 22 three times, which was 17 this year, and then the very first year in 2010. So, but you can't really control takeaways, right?
Right.
I mean,
you can't control the opportunity coming your way. You can control capitalizing on the opportunity.
Exactly. And Mara pointed that exact thing out. How many times? Three, four, five. I mean, there were six, seven different takeaways that they had. KJ had his hands on a couple, and
yeah,
I hate
Jamal,
you know,
and
saying anything about KJ, but yeah, Jamal right in the bread basket. Ugo Amadi had a chance. I mean, there was a lot of times, but you know, that's something I guess you can't really control the opportunity, but you can control, just like you said. But as far as the giveaways, I guess if you can be more conservative, you can, you know, dial things back. But again, it just seemed like if they'd have done it down near the red zone, that would have taken away, you know, two or three of those. And, you know, maybe that's – but I don't know. Maybe that's why they only had 18 giveaways. But it certainly isn't some out-of-control number.
No, and you could also say, well, he jumped in and maybe that helped save some of the giveaways. But maybe the schedule helped too.
Yeah,
they were playing the Eagles. They were playing the Jets. They were playing the Giants. They played Washington, who had a good defense. They did throw an interception against the Jets and one against the Washington football team and the Giants. Had three games in a row with one pick, but he had four touchdown passes against the Giants to one interception. So you could look at the opposition and say, well, maybe that had as much to do with the decrease in turnovers as much as Pete jumping into the middle of it. I want to play more from Brandon Marshall here. He, in his opinion, Carroll and Wilson don't see eye to eye.
They have a breakdown in philosophy. Pete Carroll wants to run the ball on first and second and third down. That's what he wants to do. He wants to win the game in the fourth quarter. Russell Wilson is a guy in his prime that's looking at his stats and looking at his legacy, and it's like, I can do more. I want to be able to leave this game knowing that I gave it my all. How do you say Russell Wilson is a top five quarterback, but then you're saying, oh, the best way for us to win is hand the ball off? I've never seen I don't know any top five quarterback, whether, you know, year to year or in the history of our game, that just handed the ball off.
I'll agree with him on one part. First of all, I don't think Pete wants to run it on first, second, and third down.
Yeah, I
think
that too.
I think if he's picking up 6 yards a carry, 5 yards a carry, then yes, he does. But as a philosophy, no. I think that's overstating it. Pete winning in the fourth quarter, that's an element of Pete that makes me uncomfortable, because he's way too comfortable with that. I think he could make his life easier if there was a little bit more urgency, if they did mix up the tempo and were a little bit more aggressive offensively, just in that sense. Not throwing it more. I have always want to stipulate that. It's not throwing it all over the field, but switching up the tempo and just getting a little bit more urgency to the offense the way they do in a two-minute drill, because they're incredibly effective. Russell is incredibly good at it, yet he's so at peace with, can you win in the first? No. Win in the second? No. Win in the fourth quarter is where it all matters. Why does it always have to come down to the fourth quarter, the final quarter? Why does it? I understand you've had a ton of success that way. I think you could still have success and make your life a little bit easier, a little less stressful.
Well, how would you control that?
I think they could switch up the tempo. I think they could not get into their rut, into their rhythms that they do. And we've talked about that over and over. And that was one of the things that Russell's pointed out, that he wants to go more tempo, that Brock has pointed out. I think they become predictable in that sense, that they're not keeping the defense on their toes. And they kind of, it feels like it gets into a lull during the game, that the defense knows they're watching the play clock. They know when the snap's coming. There is no surprise to anything. I think they develop a rhythm and the defense gets into their rhythm at the same time. And then in the fourth quarter, there's a sense of urgency. We're down by a score. We're up by one score, whatever it is. And then they start changing the tempo. All of a sudden they're moving the ball down the field.
Maybe.
And Russell's been so good at it. And Pete is so comfortable with it. Almost too comfortable, in my opinion.
Yeah, I guess I'm like, well, they want to do things and call things that work. I don't think Pete purposely wants to keep a team close to them. You know, as far as like everything, every play you call should score. And maybe they don't think Russ is necessarily good at that. Again, I'll go back to you. There are some things that you lose when you go up tempo. You lose the opportunity to get protection just right. You lose the opportunity to motion guys and screw up their coverages maybe. You know, you lose the opportunity to make sure everybody has their assignment and, you know, for the play caller to get exactly the play that he wants in there. So, you know, what I guess Russ has been good at it, but.
And he himself has, he brought it up in the clips we were playing postseason where he's just talking about wanting to play with more tempo. And so many people have brought it up outside of me, certainly.
Would you say that they did that in the first half?
Yeah.
Of the season,
yeah, that's what I love. That Shoddy was mixing it up. There seemed to be more of a keeping the defense on their toes a little bit, right? Just not allowing them the substitution or not knowing what the Seahawks were going to do, rather than they're going to milk the clock. They're going to be in that huddle for what feels like an eternity. They're going to get up to the line around 9 seconds, and then they're going to sit there and they're going to go through their reads and call protections. And by the time he snaps the ball, there's 2 seconds left on the play clock.
Yeah.
It just, in that sense, and I think that's what Turbin was talking about. When Turbin tweeted out, hey, this, you know, and this is a guy that played there in that system saying, these guys are predictable. That's from somebody who was in the middle of it and is now watching from the outside saying, for all these weapons and everything, this is very predictable. So if he's saying that, that's got to carry some weight, right?
Yeah, I agree. And you know, I'll have to say that there was a lot of times this year where when Rabel and I were calling games where I was fooled by, one of them was a bootleg by the 49ers in the last game, but I don't remember there being any that the Seahawks called where I was like, wait, where's the ball? That was really well done. That was very deceptive. And maybe that just has, you know, maybe it's just Schottenheimer. You know, when people are saying creativity, I'm always like, okay, define that. Define what is creative. But I guess I have to admit I got a little bit of that feeling when I was watching the Packers playing the Rams.
Yeah.
I'm like, look at the different plays that they're calling. It's like they come back with, you know, putting him in motion and a quick throw to the side. You know, you spread him out, and all of a sudden he breaks a tackle. Instead of 5 yards, it's 8 yards. You know, then they run it up the middle. And then, you know, they spread him out and run it up the middle again. And then they hit a tight end and a seam. And, I mean, it was just the way that they ran everything just seemed to – like I said, you know, I wasn't very surprised by the things that the Seahawks did this year. And maybe that's just Schottenheimer's personality. Maybe he just doesn't have that touch, you know, that kind of ability to be, you know, creative and make all these, you know, calls that end up surprising people. So, I mean,
don't you feel like they did the first half, though?
Well, the first half, to me, it just seemed like Russ was sitting back there and throwing deep balls, and it was fine. I mean, they hit lots of deep passes.
He had great protection.
Yeah,
we're going to get into the line protection situation because the more and more we talk about it, the more that I watch that game, I don't want to keep punishing myself, but watching that game and watching what the Packers did, the line was so much more of a problem than I think maybe we were even given credit. for. And that's not to absolve Russ or Shoddy or anybody. But I think, as we talked about in years previous, when it falls apart on the snap, I'm not sure what play call works there. I'm not sure how much you can expect from your run game. I'm not sure how much you can expect from your quarterback in certain situations when immediately there's penetration in the backfield. And we saw a lot of that. So we'll get into that with Ray. But it feels like Shoddy was one guy at the beginning of the season, and Russ had great protection, the best he's had in years. So that certainly helped and allowed them to, you know, call plays that took longer to develop. And it felt like they were still trying to call some of those plays when he didn't have that kind of time. Yeah. You know, so it wasn't, while it worked in the beginning of the season, it didn't work when the line wasn't functioning as well. And, you know, maybe Ray will shed some light on that, and maybe I'm not seeing it correctly, but that's how it felt, just in watching the protection and how quickly there were defenders in the backfield.
Well, and this is why I think this is so important, because now what you're seeing is guys like LaFleur and McVay and even Bruce Arians, even though he's an older guy, Andy Reid, they're offensive-minded coaches.
Yeah.
So and Pete's a defensive guy. So it's going to be really important who he gets in here and, you know, brings the best out of Russ. Look, you know, everybody's worried about Russell Wilson. We saw the first half. He can play. He can throw deep passes. He can,
are there people doubting whether he can play or not?
Yeah. I mean, people are saying he's too short. No, he's no good. There were lots of mistakes.
We can talk about him playing poorly. He certainly did play poorly. And maybe the worst was in the playoff game. I mean, there's no two ways around it. Nobody's trying to cover that up. But the idea that that's who he is, that becomes all of who he is. And it's not, ignore everything you've seen in every other season, in the first half of the season. What you saw at the end of the season is the real Russell Wilson. Doesn't even make sense to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. I'm just as upset about it as anybody else, but I don't look at it and go, well, he's cooked. He can't play. We've all been fooled for 9.5 seasons.
Right.
It makes no sense.
Yeah. Well, and somebody who's texting Shoddy was the scapegoat for Pete. Well, look, that's what Pete needs, though. Pete needs to get, okay, so he's the scapegoat, meaning, oh, it's all your fault. I don't think Pete is that involved. I mean, look, he dials back certain plays and everything, but, you know, he's mostly trusting his offensive coordinator to, you know, call plays that work and get us down the field. And, you know, that because he's a defensive-minded coach. So, you know, I don't think it's a matter of him being a scapegoat. I just think it was time to make a change. It's obviously not, you know, the second half of that season, it was obvious that they weren't getting the best out of Russell Wilson at all.
Yeah. One more from Brandon Marshall. Coming up in a couple minutes, we'll get to some news surrounding the University of Washington that I think Husky fans will want to hear, and it's not great news. But Brandon Marshall feels like Pete's philosophy is going to leave DK disgruntled as well.
If DK Metcalf is not given the opportunity, he's going to continue to shut him down. And then DK Metcalf is going to continue to have these outbursts. DK Metcalf is the next Megatron. So you're going to ask the next Megatron to go block on first, second, third down, when on first down, you're given the best opportunity to win, because that's when you usually get one-on-one matchups. I think there's going to be a lot of sleepless nights in Seattle, Nick, because Pete Carroll is botching this era. This is no longer the Legion of Doom. You don't have Earl Thomas. You don't have those guys on the other side. The only way you can get it done is have a change of philosophy and say, we're going to win and lose with Russell Wilson.
Well, it was never the Legion of Doom.
I was going to say, on the cutting edge of that, that name being made up.
Yeah, it's again, I'm going to disagree with him on the first, second, and third down. Pete does not want to run unless they're averaging 5 yards per carry. He doesn't want to run the ball first, second, third, then try to pick up the first down on third down. It's just not who he is. I understand he is a run first guy. I understand he's very risk averse and he wants to control the ball and protect the ball. But the idea that he, in a perfect world, Pete Carroll's going to go, you know what? We're going to just run it first through third downs and hopefully we get the first down. If not, we'll punt and live to play another drive. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, and he's never just run. And as a matter of fact, even in the second half, when we talked to Ray Roberts, he was complaining a lot during the second half of the season that they weren't committing enough to the run, that they were running. Yeah. They had a game where they never ran back-to-back plays.
Twice in a row, yeah. Plays.
So, and then there was another half of a different game where it wasn't going on. So I'll have to ask Ray about that. But, yeah, so, I mean, he got away from that. So, and then again, like I talked about yesterday, you know, 7 of the top 10 run games, best running teams make it to the playoffs every year. And over the last 5 years, it's an average of about 7 out of the top 10. So, yeah, you have to run the ball, but nobody's running it on first, second, and third down. And they certainly didn't do that this year. I mean, yeah. So, I mean, my biggest concern was that why weren't there guys open in zones? And why was it so easy for Aaron Rodgers to, you know, crack that cover two that the Rams so perplexed the Seahawks with? That was the part that was more disturbing to me.
All right, let's take two.
Take two.
UW defensive coordinator Pete Kwiatkowski is reportedly leaving to take the same position, defensive coordinator at Texas.
About that. He's been with them since 2014. Their defense has been kind of the calling card under his tutelage, and he's leaving. And just as a point of reference, Moore has got on here, 9 UW defensive players have been selected in the first two rounds of the draft since he took over in 2014. So, tells you the kind of player he's developing there, that they've been able to recruit and develop under his watchful eye. So that's a big blow. That's a big blow to this football team.
And I think he came with Peterson, I believe, from Boise State. And then Jimmy Lake was made the co-defensive coordinator. But, yeah, it seems like the coaching talent is going to places like Texas. From what I understand, Texas has amazing resources as far as their football program. I mean,
it doesn't surprise you, right? I mean, high school football is religion out there.
Yeah.
They play in stadiums,
right?
High school teams.
Yeah, it's a big deal there, and it's a big step for Kwiatkowski. I'll be rooting for him, but yeah, that's a tough one.
The rave reviews of Mariners prospects keep coming in. Julio Rodriguez and Jared Kelnick are ranked as the number 3 and 4 prospects by Baseball America.
You mean 3 and 4 overall in all of baseball, Dave? Not just in the Mariners organization, in all of baseball.
Wow.
When have the Mariners been able to say that? I'd have to go back and look and see their history. And again, this doesn't mean that
Junior,
every one of these guys pans out and becomes a superstar. Baseball, more than any, you talk about the draft being a crapshoot. Baseball, by far and away, is the biggest crapshoot there is. You could, as we will learn with Dustin Ackley and Mike Zunino, and you know whether they're the second, third overall, fifth overall, guarantees you nothing. Guarantees you absolutely nothing. It's all bottled promise. It's all potential.
Well, and they're high school kids too. And then there's there's all kinds. I mean, you're scouring the world basically. I mean, being a baseball scout.
Well, yeah, and you're drafting guys who, in most cases, you're not going to see for years.
Right.
Versus the NFL, you're going to see them that season. You know, so you're going to draft. You're going to hear Julio Rodriguez's name, and then you're not going to see him at the big leagues for a couple of years, and who knows what happens in that time. It's just such a weird thing in baseball, but it's so cool to see the attention being paid to this minor league system, that the core that they've got right now is exciting with Crawford and Evan White and the guys that they've got up at the big league with Kyle Lewis and the guys that have yet to come up. It gives you a lot of hope. As a beleaguered Mariner fan, I am fired up to see these guys, more fired up than I've been in any time recently that I can think of.
Yeah, this is going to be so exciting to watch these guys actually get on the field. We've seen little glimpses of them every once in a while, but yeah, these two guys in particular, Kelenic and Rodriguez, really exciting. And yeah, I'm looking forward to Mariner baseball.
All right, coming up, this year's NFL Combine has been canceled. How much is that going to impact the draft? And does it make you look at the Seahawks giving up as much as they did in draft capital for Jamal Adams a little differently? We'll talk about that next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
It is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Coming up at 3 o'clock, Michael Bumpus will join us on the program. Spend the 3 o'clock hour with us. This hour of Wyman and Bob is brought to you by Muckleshoot Casino. Meanwhile, no combine this year, Dave, which, you know, Graz used to always make fun of me. I like watching the combine.
I do, too.
I don't sit there and watch hour after hour after hour.
I do.
Do you?
I would tape it and watch.
That's what I would do. I would kind of forward through. I'd look for guys that I'd heard a lot about. Like, let me see this Patrick Queen guy. Let me see this Jordan Brooks guy. Let me see anybody that was being talked about. I want to make sure I kind of saw them just to get a feel for what they look like. And and I got to be honest, I'm amazed at how fast the big guys are, whether they're defensive linemen or offensive linemen. And, you know, I think it's funny that you'll see some of the 40 times on the O linemen and go, guy's slow. You're thinking, you know, 5'4", 5'3", yeah, something like that. There are very few people that are going to beat that, that are listening or watching at home.
Right.
You know, we saw it with the media Olympics, right, at the VMAC. Nobody was under 5. You know, John Boyle, I think, had the fastest time. He was a 5-something. That's a very thin guy who runs all the time.
Right.
He's going to be beaten by off. So it just shows you how athletic these guys truly are.
Right.
But I just love watching. I love watching the agility. I love watching the bench press. I don't know why. I guess I'm a geek with that stuff. But this is a bummer. And I'm wondering, in your opinion, how much does this impact the draft, a team's ability to assess players? Because we've debated how, you know, listen, it's all about the game tape. What do they look like when they're playing versus in shorts running a 40, right? In the interview. To me, the interview is the most important thing at this, because you've got game tape on this guy. You know what they look like. You know how they play, if they're aggressive, if they're hitters, if they're whatever. But the interview is the biggest part of the combine, in my opinion. But what do you think? No combine, what kind of impact is that?
Well, I think it's huge. And Maura and I were talking about, you know, we were talking earlier about the baseball draft being a crapshoot, but it's, you know, I think the NFL is as well, but it's going to be even more of one now, because, I don't know, I just heard coaches say there's a lot that you can get from a guy's body language. Here's the other thing, too, is how you compete. And you know, I went back there in 1987, Indianapolis, and here I'm there with 25 of the best linebackers I was one of 25 in the nation. And so we're all, you know, following each other around, doing the bench press, doing the vertical jump, doing the 40. And you compete with these guys, and you see, like, how those guys interact with other people. I mean, there are some guys that fold, you know, that look around like, wow. You know, I remember my year, it was like, yeah, I knew who Cornelius Bennett was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew who Shane Conlon was. Yeah. I mean, you know, and I went out and I didn't have my best. I mean, I ran like a 4.74, which was terrible for me at the time. I think on my pro day, I ran in the 4.6s. So, I mean, that might have come into play, that they thought, okay, this guy, you know, can't compete when, you know, the bright lights are on and he's got, you know, a tougher competition around him. And then, you know, you see other guys. There was one guy that ran a really good 40. His name was Rick Graff, and he ended up getting drafted ahead of me and didn't have much of a career, but he had a really good combine. And so I think
Mike Mamula, he's the biggest example, right? Yeah. Every year everybody brings him up.
Well, and you know, everybody always clowns the teams that pick him, because it's like, oh, he was really good at the underwear Olympics. But it's also about how they compete and how they handle that situation. And so now that's all gone, is my point. You know, that's all gone. And I'm with you, man. I love watching. And one time I remember,
is that
back,
a sickness? Are we sick?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think we really, really, really like football.
Do you think our listeners watch the combine too, or do they look at it the way Graz used to just mock me? What are you watching that for? Who cares?
Right.
I care. I'm interested. I like seeing these guys.
I remember back when the Seahawks were really good, you know, and the first time around with Holmgren in 05, and I was at some barbecue in my street, and I was like, we were talking about how, you know, some of the big offensive linemen, how they look slow, and I'm like, I guarantee you that Walter Jones could beat anybody here in a 40-yard dash. And they're like, no way, that guy's too big. And I'm like, I'm telling you, he's the dancing bear.
Yeah.
You know, but
it's deceptive.
Yeah. So, I mean, that part's impressive to see. But I remember watching KJ Wright. I bring this up all the time just because I remember going, wow, that guy's really unusual. Look at the way, and, you know, I was watching him run, and I'm like, he looks like he's not running very fast, but, man, he's covering ground. So, you know, that's you just see some of those kinds of things from people that are players that, you know, Mataafa. I thought he had a pretty good combine, you know, Hercules Mataafa. And, you know, we'll see how that works out for him. But it's just fun watching that stuff. But it's going to be tougher now. And Maura and I had this conversation that it's going to be tougher to analyze these guys because, you know, now they're doing it at their own pro day, which is, you know, their home field, everything's set up for them. There's not that competition and everything that's going on. You don't have to go to Indianapolis. And I think you're going to be able to figure out less about these players.
Yeah.
Coming off a season where the vast majority of college football teams didn't have a full schedule.
Yep.
And you know, that might be why John Schneider traded away the first round draft choices. you know, because it's just going to be harder and harder. Plus, we're going to be at the bottom again.
Mm-hmm.
And so whoever, you know, the Jets get the draft choices, they're going to be in what Clayton always talks about, from 21 to 32, 75% don't get to their second contract. Those aren't true first-round draft choices.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe John Schneider thinks that. So, you know,
which we've seen here.
Right.
Right? James Carpenter, Jermaine Ifedi. We'll see what happens with Penny. You know, Jordan Brooks looks like a guy that could be, you know, somebody that gets another contract. But LJ Collier is a question mark, in my opinion.
I agree.
So, I got to tell you, I don't have any issues at all. I want to make that clear. None with what they gave up for Jamal Adams. I love Jamal Adams. Maybe they'll come back to bite me as a fan years down the road. Maybe he won't be good. He'll be a pro. Who knows? But as we stand right now, based on what we got from him this year, and not even in 16 games, I love the way he plays different than anybody on that defense. He brings an edge that nobody else seems to bring, an attitude, an intensity. And if we're being honest, we just talked about a couple of the picks. Seahawks have done well in the first round. They just haven't. They're always at the bottom. Haven't made a lot of hay there. I just don't have a big problem with what they gave up. I'm not going to go, boy, if only they had that pick. What could they have done?
Well, you know, the old saying, bird in a hand, worth two in the bush. Yeah. I mean, look, these are going to be 21 through 32 picks. And next year, the Seahawks are going to have success. Okay, mm-hmm. Define success, 12-4 and lose in the first round of the playoffs, I don't know. I certainly hope not. But still, they're going to be in that 21 through 32 that Clayton talks about. And so that's what you're trading away. Now, could you have, you know, and I sometimes instead of having LJ Collier, why didn't they trade back? You know, they thought, you know, they took a shot on a guy like LJ Collier. And I'm with you. I mean, he still needs to prove that he was a first-round draft choice. You know, I thought he played good. Like, I thought he played this last year like he should have played his rookie year.
If he played his rookie year like this year, I'd feel much more strongly about him.
Yeah.
At this point, I'm feeling like him and Rasheem Green are just guys. I think they can play. I think they're capable of making plays. I don't think they're Pro Bowlers. I don't think they're difference makers. I think they're just guys that are part of a rotation. And maybe Collier will take the next step next year and really excel. I'm pulling for that, obviously. But at this point, to me, they're guys.
Well, and that's okay for Rasheem Green because he's a third-round draft choice. Yeah, I mean, that's how you fill up your roster, you know, the back end of your roster. So, but, I mean, and also it makes it really impressive, the performance of Alton Robinson. And I'm going to start breaking down these guys on Football 101. And Alton Robinson, I don't know if you remember in the Cowboy game, he blew up or he diagnosed a reverse.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't make the tackle, but somebody else did. And he was mad that he didn't make the tackle. And then he diagnosed a fly sweep and made a tackle in the backfield in the playoff game. And he got four sacks. So, I mean, you know, some of those are the kinds of – and the reason why I bring him up, that's where John Schneider makes his hay. Is, you know, third through seventh, you know, with Chris Carson and David Moore. So, yeah, you've got a player who truly, like Jamal Adams, when you have a guy with that kind of talent, you can't really compare him to anybody. Who would you compare him to? I mean, not Earl Thomas.
He plays that way? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, he
Cam didn't play that way. Cam was a hitter. Cam was not great in coverage his first few years here, if we're being honest. He was a bit of a liability. And I think you talk about when he got his extension, you were kind of like, whoa, boy, really? You know, there were some questions. It was sort of like Jim with giving Tyler Lockett the extension. Like, really? And then you go on to feel like, man, that's a bargain.
He played up to it.
Yeah, but at the time, he was not great. But he didn't play the same way. He wasn't up on the line of on the line of scrimmage the way Adams is. So he's incredibly unique. He's just a guy that makes plays. He doesn't make every one. And obviously, we talked about interceptions he dropped that he didn't come up with, but man, there's a lot more good that comes out of that guy than bad by a long shot.
Yes, absolutely. So, yeah, two late round first rounders. And again, they're going to be late round picks next year. They will be in the mix. They're going to have double digit wins. It's going to be that kind of pick. That's what you're trading away for a player that you and I are having a hard time even describing right now.
All right, coming up, Mariners GM Jerry Dipoto spoke with the media as part of their virtual baseball bash this week. We're going to let you hear a bit of what he had to say. Coming up with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Who will become the next offensive coordinator of the Seahawks?
All right, coming up at 3 o'clock, Michael Bumpus will spend the hour with us, so stay tuned for that. Meanwhile, we touched on baseball briefly as the Mariners, their minor league system is being rated highly by everybody. They've got the number 3 and 4 prospects, according to Baseball America and Rodriguez and Kelnick. And Jerry DePoto was part of their virtual baseball bash that they've got going on this week and hit on a few different things. He's talking about the prospects and who are the next wave, right? We've seen Evan White. You've seen Crawford. You've seen Lewis. You've seen Sheffield, you know, up at the big league level. But who are the next wave we're going to see?
The obvious for us are Logan Gilbert, who I think among our group is the closest to major league preparedness. He's just where he is emotionally, what he does physically. He was outstanding at the alt site during the summer last year. We do have to be conscious of where his innings are, and you know, my preference would be with all young players is just to give them the opportunity to onboard at the appropriate pace. But Logan stands out, as does Jared Kelnick, Cal Raleigh, potentially Taylor Trammell, who we are still learning a lot about. But you know, he's another of those that we haven't yet seen at the major league level.
So that's a nice list of young guys that, you know, they don't seem to be in a hurry, which they don't need to be. And we talked about this last season, that there is no urgency here. There is no urgency. If somebody, if they're not convinced that whether it's Kelnick, Rodriguez, Trammell, whoever they're talking about, if they're not 100% sold that they're ready to take that next step, there's no urgency. It's not, they're not the difference between making it to the playoffs and not making it. They're not the difference between a World Series and not winning the World Series right now. Right now. So there's no urgency. I'm way on the side of erring on the side of caution. Take your time. Take your time. You don't have to rush them up, and this is not because of Ackley or Zunino, who a lot of people felt were rushed up too quickly, and maybe they were, maybe they weren't. Who knows? Maybe they weren't going to pan out regardless. But they're in this situation where I think the fan base is accepted. Doesn't mean they're happy, but sort of accepted. It's a rebuild. It's a full commitment to a rebuild. Allow the time. Allow these guys the time to develop, because they're going to be part of the situation for years to come. You develop them the right way, you're ensuring as much as you can in baseball that you're going to be a competitive product year in, year out.
Well, and I get the feeling that Mariner fans have adopted that patience, that they're okay with that, because you've come a long ways. Why would you want to hurry somebody up and ruin the process? I like that, you know, he said Logan Gilbert's the closest to playing right now.
Yeah.
But then, you know, he didn't stop there. Then he went, you know, and Kelenic, and then Raleigh, and then Trammell. So, and then in the meantime, you know, you've got Dylan Moore, you know, Kyle Lewis, J.P. Crawford. I mean, lots of prospects, you know, Ty France. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, good players that are you know, kind of taking that next step as well. Marco Gonzalez will just get better and better.
Mm-hmm. Evan White.
Yep. Evan White.
Gold Glover Evan White.
Exactly.
So you get the bat going.
Yeah. So, and then you bring these young guys up slowly. It's just going to be really exciting to watch them. But I'm really interested with all the guys that I just mentioned, you know, how they're able to capitalize on them and see just how good they are without all of these superstar prospects coming into play.
Yeah, he went on to talk about, you know, guys like, you know, Rodriguez, Kelnick, Gilbert, all these guys. I think he was asked whether they'd be affected by not having that minor league season last year.
With the young prospects of elite talent, that it's the same way. You know, you could see guys like a Julio Rodriguez or a Jared Kelnick or a Logan Gilbert. They will not miss it as much as some others who might have needed that step by step. So we're going to be open-minded to using 2021 as an opportunity to move some of those guys a little quicker if that's what it appears is good for their development. And if they need more time, we're going to be receptive to that as well.
I like it. I like what he's saying.
You know, it's interesting, though. How do you determine that? I mean, I just keeping a close, watchful eye.
Trusting your scouts, you know, getting those scouting reports on what they're doing, where they're struggling, where they're excelling, you know, and how they're handling if they move up from, you know, AA to AAA. How is that? Yeah, it's such a process.
Yeah.
It is such a long process in baseball.
And I'm sure service is good at, you know, how does a guy respond to success, failure, especially, you know, and that's really what the game of baseball is all about, right? Is surviving failure over a long, consistent period of time.
Yeah, because if you fail 7 out of 10 times up at the plate for your career, you're a Hall of Famer.
Pretty good.
It's a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
You got a 300 batting average for your career. I mean, you're talking about a guy who's making generational wealth.
Yeah.
You're talking about a guy who's going to be a Hall of Fame. I mean, it's so different, the approach to baseball versus football, where there's immediate evaluation of a player in a draft. Jordan Brooks, it's immediate. Maybe he doesn't get in right away, but you see him that season. He's a college player one day. The very next football season in the pros, he's a pro.
Right.
And you're seeing him. There is no, you know, single A, high A, double A, triple A. There's none of that. And we don't even see these guys. All we do is hear or read about them, right? We can watch football players at the college level. We tune into those games every weekend. So you come in with some level of familiarity with those players and a sense of who they are versus, you know, Kelnick or Rodriguez. We're just going on maybe some highlights we see here and there, maybe, but for the most part, it's about reading what scouts are saying or what, you know, reading about or hearing about. You don't see it. It's just such a different thing.
Well, and it's like, you know, you see Kelenic hit a bomb, and that's impressive to all of us. But, you know, the scouts will tell you, oh, that was a pitch that he usually doesn't handle well.
Yeah.
Look what he did. Watch his mechanics. You know, it's like the difference between looking at somebody's stats in the NFL and then actually watching them on film and seeing, you know, yeah, that was a tackle, but it was 14 yards downfield, right?
So Yeah.
This is
a little deceiving.
This is why I should have been a baseball player because, yeah, I made about 3 out of 10 possible tackles, Bob, but that doesn't get it done. That was not success.
That's not Hall of Fame worthy?
It's not Hall of Fame.
All right, a couple more from Jerry. Just talking about young teams, and the Mariners, one of the youngest in all of baseball. Just talking about young teams tend to gel quickly.
Young teams tend to gel quicker than you might think. We can't go in expecting that we're going to run to the top of the American League West. But I think we can set the goal of competing for a playoff spot, and we'll see how it goes. And if we take a step toward that in 2021, I think that would be a great achievement for our organization.
And then just continuing with that, just saying it's possible they could sneak into that postseason picture.
First and foremost, it's to gain that experience, to continue to grow the base, you know, with the guys that I mentioned earlier, you know, Chef and Kyle and Evan and the like, and then introduce the next group with the idea that if things break well for us and we get into midsummer and we stay close to this thing and we do have an opportunity to sneak up on the back of the playoff field, that's a possibility for us and would be a goal.
So, you know, if I'm betting, am I betting that they're a playoff team this season? Probably not. If I had to bet, could they do it? Certainly. My question centered around the rotation. I'm not certain about the rotation and the bullpen, which is absolutely – as much as the bullpen is just a revolving door, right? Every year it's just new faces, old people leaving, people coming, people going. It's just how the bullpen is run. It's such a huge part of your success and failure. You know, we see it every year. If a guy can get you through five and keep you in the game and he gives up 3 runs, gives you a quality start, you're living and dying with your bullpen every year. And we've seen the Mariners have great bullpens and disastrous ones. So not knowing really what they've got in the bullpen, what that's going to look like, or the rotation, that's where my hesitation is. I love what they've got with the position players. I feel really good about their position players. It's all about their starting rotation, the bullpen for me.
Yeah. Well, and it's such a weird one because you can have a great closer 1 year and then ship him off somewhere else and he's terrible the next year. I mean, it's one of those.
You saw with Diaz here.
Yeah. I mean, it was just tough to explain some of that and how it happens. But yeah, I think everybody is pretty excited about the positional players, but that's the big question. That's going to be the big question. And then just seeing the development of like Sheffield and really Marco too. I mean, look, he's taken that next step. He's the leader, everything, but just how good can he be?
All right, coming up, we'll talk Seahawks. Michael Bumpus is going to join us for the entire 3 o'clock hour. We'll get his take on the Seahawks offensive coordinator search, and also wanted him to weigh in on the people, and we've had some people text in about trading Russell Wilson. Get his take on that as well. That's Wyman and Bob coming up on 710 ESPN Seattle.